Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, we'll talk about you, talk with you about your subject, and we'll also entertain calls if you have questions or, I should say, disagreements about things that the host has said, and you can call about that as well. The number to get through is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And our first caller today is Paul from Washington State. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi there, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I got a kind of a multi-part question. I'll just kind of spill it out and then listen. When we as Christians die, what happens to our soul? Do we go to heaven immediately? And would a non-believer go to hell immediately? Do you think we'll actually see others we have known and recognize them? People sometimes say, well, they're in a better place, and if they're not a Christian, I sometimes want to respond, you know, why do you say that? And but I, you know, want to strengthen why I believe what I believe. So I wanted your response. I was curious your response to those questions.
Well, when people die on bad terms with God, I don't think we could say they're in a better place. We're not told very much in the Bible about what happens to unbelievers when they die. There's one story that people sometimes appeal to called Lazarus and the Rich Man, found in Luke chapter 16, beginning with verse 19. It tells about two men who died, one righteous and one unrighteous, apparently. And the one who is unrighteous is seen tormented in flames right after death. This is, in all likelihood, a parable. And it's hard to know exactly to what degree it is giving a literal picture of the afterlife. But without that, we have nothing really in the Bible about the afterlife for unbelievers, in my opinion. So the Bible doesn't really tell us much about unbelievers. It may well be that, you know, when they die, they're unconscious until they're raised and taken to judgment. Now, Christians, on the other hand, I believe, do go directly to be with God. Our bodies don't. There's a resurrection on the last day when Jesus comes back, and he'll raise our bodies as well as the bodies of the wicked. Jesus says he's going to raise both on that day in John chapter 5, verses 28 and 29. But in the meantime, you know, after we die but before he raises our bodies, I believe our souls are departed from our bodies and with Christ. Paul talked about being absent from the body and seem to equate it with being present with the Lord. So that would be the most we really know on the subject.
Okay, so we may not see heaven until after Christ comes again.
Well, I believe we will. I believe we'll be present with the Lord when we die. That I think that our bodies will be in the grave, but our conscious selves will leave our bodies. We are not the same thing as our body. Our body is where we live in this life and where we will live when it's glorified after the resurrection. But Paul talked about us being absent from our bodies. So if I can be absent from my body is not me. I can't be absent from me. I'm absent from my body at death, just like I'm absent from my home at this moment. So Paul talked about being present in the body or absent from the body. And I believe that when we're absent from our bodies, that is, when we die, but before the time that Christ raises us, we are, in fact, with the Lord. And that is in heaven. That's where he is. I appreciate your call. Let's talk to Steve from Las Vegas, Nevada. Steve, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Steve, are you there? Okay, Steve's not there. Let's go on and talk to Mike from Albany, Oregon. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to add to the conversation about suicide that people
okay.
Had brought up last week. And something that when my wife was a teenager, she went through a period of suicidal thoughts for a long time. And for her, selfishness may have been part of it, but she was thinking, she had a false understanding of how it would affect people. She was thinking that if she was gone, life would be better for everyone else. It would be hard for a little while, but then it would be better than if she was there. So this feeling of worthlessness is one of the reasons that people do commit suicide. And especially for older people who, you know, they get a disease that they know is going to be a burden and expensive on everyone. And, you know, they might commit suicide for that reason. But the feeling of worthlessness or that being a burden is one of the things that can contribute to that. But I also have a question for you, too, unless you want to kind of discuss that further.
Well, let me just say about that, I think you could be right. I mean, there are people who don't give enough thought to other people to realize that other people would feel guilt or loss or grief if they were to commit suicide. But we should give more thought to other people. That's just the point. A person who commits suicide is only thinking about themselves. Now, a young person may perhaps be excused for not knowing the way that parents feel about their children. I mean, children can hardly know how their parents feel about them. Anyone who knows how parents feel about their children would know that it'd be a terrible cruelty to parents for one to commit suicide. Even if it's an adult child committing suicide, if their parents are still living, it's terribly cruel. If their parents aren't living, they may have children who are living, or spouses that are living, or at least friends that are living. And you know, if they say, well, I don't think it'll hurt anyone's, I don't think anyone will bother if I kill myself, then they're simply not thinking very carefully about other people. Once again, it's a symptom of thinking about themselves only, because anyone who is conditioned, as Christians are to be, to think about other people's needs and other people's feelings and other people's well-being above one's own, which is what Christianity calls us to do, would have spent enough time thinking about other people's feelings. Oh, they might feel guilty about me dying if they feel like it was because of something they did, or they may just experience grief. But I think most people, they probably even know that someone will feel grief, but they probably think, well, it's worth it. They'll get over it. But again, to kill oneself, and even if they're not doing it to hurt somebody else, sometimes they are. Sometimes they're trying to get back at somebody who rejected them, somebody, they'll feel sorry when I'm gone, you know, kind of thing. But even if it's not that, even if they're not giving a thought at all to what someone else will think, that's in itself a sin, not to give thought to how your actions will impact somebody else negatively.
Right,
we should be always mindful of those things. Yeah.
When she was going through that, she wasn't like she was Catholic at the time, but she hadn't really identified as, you know, a follower of Jesus.
Yeah.
I think personally for a little while, and obviously teenagers can go through all kinds of ups and downs as you know they're going through all the changes that they go through. I just want to point out that's, you know, another big cause is just people mistakenly thinking that the world and even their family is better off if they're gone. That can contribute it to. And that can be, I mean, that really understanding the doctrine of Christ can really actually help in that in significant ways if people.
Right. Because
take the
once
time
you're,
to really think it through. But
once you're a follower of Christ, you are, as I said, conditioned to be thinking about other people and knowing how the impact of your actions may affect them. That's true. But of course, non-Christians, they don't think like Christians, and they're very susceptible to the lies of the devil. And if somebody's out there thinking, well, if I kill myself, it won't bother anybody, that's the devil lying to you. But if you don't know Christ, then you've got very little, vulnerability. You've got very little protection from the lies of the devil.
Right. It's a complicated thing. I feel bad for anyone going through anything close to those kind of thoughts. But the question I had for you was actually in Matthew 19:29. So we have Paul talking about how, like, if you don't provide for your own, you're worse than an infidel. And then to Timothy, he's telling Timothy to only call people to positions of authority who have their family in order, because, you know, I would think, because your main responsibility, if your family isn't with Christ, is to work with them. But then in Matthew 19:29, after talking to the rich young man, Jesus says that everyone who's left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or fields for the sake of my name will receive a hundredfold and will inherit eternal life. And I'm wondering what context would that even be in? It seems like to follow Jesus, you would be even more committed to your wife and to your children and to your responsibilities, not less of, unless it was like a temporary thing, like, you know, maybe there was a mission call that was urgent or something like that. But
well, yeah,
what are your thoughts on situations?
To forsake wife and children may simply mean that you just don't get married or have kids, because virtually everyone in that society, unlike our present society, but in most societies throughout history, and certainly in biblical times, people planned to get married and have a family and, you know, leave children to carry on their name after they're dead. It's very common. It was almost a universal expectation that people had. And yet if a person follows Christ and decides not to marry, because earlier, you know, Jesus did say some people make themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He said it earlier in the same chapter, meaning they choose to live obviously not to be married, not to have sex. That's choosing to be a eunuch. And so that's perhaps what he has in mind, that people would naturally want to get married, have a wife and children. But if someone forsakes that goal, not somebody who has a wife and children and the responsibilities of a family, but somebody who has not yet had it. You know, the disciples of Jesus, the 12, were pretty young men in all likelihood. We don't know their actual age, but a very good chance that they were young, perhaps in their teens. Peter was married. Mm-hmm. We know Peter was married, but we don't read until later in their lives that others were married. Now, Paul did say in 1 Corinthians 9 that Peter and the other apostles and the brothers of the Lord were married, and they brought their wives with them places. But this was later in their lives, probably after their children were grown. They could travel with their wives, probably not with their children. And so I don't think Jesus is saying you can walk out on your family responsibilities, but I think he's saying you may, for the kingdom of heaven's sake, choose to be a eunuch. You may choose not to marry, not to have sex at all, never to have children or a wife. And he said, don't worry, if you give that up, you'll still have plenty of consolation and reward hundredfold from God. Now, so I don't see him suggesting that people who have family responsibilities can walk away from them. Now, it may well be, though, that a man who's called to follow God tells his family, hey, we're going to follow God, and they say, no, we're not. You may, but I'm not. You know, and the family may forsake him, in which case his loyalty to God is causing him to give up the loyalty of his family. And they are the ones in the wrong then. They're the ones, you know, taking themselves out of the loop. He's not. A man can never leave his family. Well, I shouldn't say can never leave his family. There might be things that, you know, for the good of the family or for the good of the kingdom, he has to, like a soldier. You know, a soldier goes off to war and leaves his family at home. For the good of, he's doing it for the good of his family and for his society. And yet, I don't think God calls people to be missionaries and to go off without their families. Sometimes missionaries have done that. Sometimes missionaries have taken their wives but left their children in boarding schools while they go on the mission field. I don't think that's what Jesus is saying. I don't think that's what Jesus calls people to do, honestly. We don't ever read of any missionaries having children and leaving them behind while they go and serve God. But we do read of the apostles in later years, like 20 years after the ascension of Christ, Paul mentions that the apostles who have wives are traveling with them. But that's probably because their children by this time are grown up. And that might even be why, even though Jesus told the apostles before he left, go to all the nations, but they didn't. They didn't for about 20 years after that. Maybe they had to finish raising their kids and then they went. So It may have been understood. Yeah, well, that's what I'm going to do. You know, once these responsibilities have been fulfilled, I think God wants me to take care of my wife and children. So,
yeah,
I think that's how we're to look at that.
I was because it confused me because it's so different than everything else that, you know, Paul says about families, and then because he says right after father and mother, like if you're forsaking your father and mother, you already have a father and mother because everyone
right.
does. Right. And
right.
then he says, or wife or children. So it, to me, it sounded like you'd be walking away from that, which didn't make any sense at all. But yeah, that
but he could very well,
I could see,
he could very well mean walking away from the prospect of wife and children, you know?
Right.
And that
right.
you're leaving your parents and you're leaving behind the prospect of having your own family too.
Right. And in persecution, if you're going to be thrown in jail and you have the choice
yeah.
of denying Christ or not, then
right. You can't love your family more than you love Christ. Yeah. You can't deny
right.
Christ, for example, for the sake of your family.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I appreciate that. See, that's really helpful to kind of get that perspective of he may be talking about people just not taking wives in the first place. But
I think very possibly. All right. Well, thanks for your call, brother. Let's talk to Don from Vancouver, Washington. Don, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Hey, I sent you an email, and I don't know if you got it or not, but our atheist friend across the river in Portland, he's been calling. Last week he had, was talking about how bad Christianity was and how it hadn't helped the world. And a book that I would urge him to read, if he's willing to, would be How Christianity Changed the World. It's a classic, and you've probably heard of it, correct?
Yeah, I have it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I do too. Okay, I'd even loan it to the guy if he, you know, actually read it. But anyway, that did a very good job documenting how Christianity did indeed change the world and how the benefits of it. And that's all I have for today. I just wanted,
okay.
if possible, for him to hear about that.
Okay, Don. Thank you for recommending that. Let's talk to Joe from St. Louis, Missouri. Joe, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Steve, how you doing?
Good.
I've called before. I had a question for you, but I'm going to have that for another day because I don't want to kick a dead dog, but there is something I want to talk about the suicide thing that was brought up a few days ago. Mm-hmm. And that is, through my experience, I have some experience with this, and through my experience, people who are depressed don't kill themselves. God has placed inside of us something for preservation of life. And when somebody loses hope, there's no hope, that suppresses that preservation and they're able to kill themselves.
Hmm.
It's more than just depression. It's the loss of hope. And that, I think, is the sin for a Christian, to lose all hope that God can't do anything for them. I think the argument that you made about the Ten Commandments was a bit weak. I don't believe that the Ten Commandments is for is personally for us. I believe that part of it's for God, how we react to God, and then the rest of it is how we react to our fellow man or neighbor. For instance,
I
can't.
By the way, I don't teach that the Ten Commandments are for us. I teach that the Ten Commandments are part of the law, and we're not under the Ten Commandments. But the New Testament, including Jesus, forbids murder and adultery and stealing and things like that. We have to keep what Jesus said, not because of any parallels that may have to the Ten Commandments, but because it's Jesus. And so Christians are forbidden to kill, just like the Jews were. And by the way, even before the Ten Commandments were given, it was forbidden to murder. I mean, Cain was punished for killing his brother because it was a wrong thing to do. So that was a long time before there were Ten Commandments. So, I mean, murder and adultery and stealing and things like that have been seen as immoral and wrong in every society before the Ten Commandments were given. And, of course, they're still immoral after the Ten Commandments have passed. The Ten Commandments simply included them, along with many other things, but not as new commandments or not as things that are bound at the hip to those commandments, because the Ten Commandments didn't make murder wrong by forbidding it. the Ten Commandments forbade it because it was wrong. It was already wrong, and it's still wrong. So, yeah, I didn't make a point that we have to keep the Ten Commandments.
No, I didn't think you did. What I'm saying is you referred to the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not murder. And there is a difference between murder and killing. We're called off to war to kill the enemy. That is not murder. There's a difference between that. And it really has to do with the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus talks about murder. Murder
so
is
what's
malice
your point?
In the heart.
So what is your point today?
My point is murder is malice in the heart. If I have malice against somebody, that's murder. Killing is not murder. And I'm saying that I believe that the better argument would be the loss of hope is the sin, not the murder. I don't think you can murder yourself.
Well, in the Old Testament, murder is defined as shedding innocent blood. And the Bible says that, you know, whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. That's the first law against murder. It actually says in the law of Moses that a land cannot be purged of the stain of the innocent blood that was shed without the bloodshed of the person who did the murder. So it's not, you're right. Jesus said, if you hate your brother, if you're angry at your brother without a cause, then you've committed murder in your heart. But he's not saying that murder always is hatred. It's just saying that, you know, you're kind of you're in the realm of murder in your heart when you hate somebody. But murder is actually, at least in biblical times, defined as shedding innocent blood. So I think that if a person who has not committed murder or not done anything worthy of death, let's say, kills themselves, then they're shedding innocent blood, and that's not something we're allowed to do. I appreciate your call. Let's talk to Alex from Washington State. Alex, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Kills himself.
You got to turn your radio down, please.
That's not something we're allowed to do.
Alex, turn your radio down.
Let's talk to Alex from Washington State. Alex, welcome to the Narrow Path.
He'll be on the phone now because he heard me say Alex just now.
Yeah, hi, Steve.
Hey, Alex, turn your radio off. Turn your radio off, please.
I just did.
Okay, because I was calling you for several seconds before you.
Are we good now? Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I appreciate what you do. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. What's up?
Okay. My question today is I have a question about creation and the dinosaurs. Were they part of the original creation? And I think Adam was asked to name the animals, so it's kind of hard for me to believe he was there. You know, well, we'll call this one T-Rex because I mean the thing might have eaten.
Well, he didn't. Adam didn't speak our language, so he wouldn't give them the names that we give them. For example, we call a certain kind of animal a dog in different languages; they have a different word for it. We don't know what language Adam spoke. He might have spoken Hebrew or some other, you know, what we call a Semitic language. We don't know what his language was. So we don't know what he would have called them. But if he named the animals, then I would say he named the animals. And therefore, since dinosaurs were animals, you know, people, somehow they think dinosaurs are not the same thing as animals because the Bible says that God made, you know, all the creatures in the sea and in the air on the sixth day. Fifth day, and on the sixth day he made the land animals. And, you know, that would include all the animals in those eco zones, I believe, and that would include the dinosaurs that were in those zones. Now, you said, are they part of the original creation? I know that some people teach that there was an earlier creation and in Genesis 1:1, and that the dinosaurs lived back at that time, and then after some millions or billions of years, God destroyed that creation and remade it in Genesis 1:2. I don't think the Bible teaches that. Now, as far as, you know, how could man live alongside dinosaurs? Well, how do men live alongside lions and tigers? For the most part, they mostly don't live in the same areas where the lions and the tigers live. If they do, they sometimes get eaten. Sometimes they hump them and so forth. So, I mean, dinosaurs, some dinosaurs would have been extremely dangerous, obviously. But I would imagine if I was on a planet where there were dinosaurs roaming, I'd probably make my home in a region where different than where they were living. So, I mean, dangerous animals exist. There's sharks. Sharks are very dangerous animals, and therefore I don't live in the sea. I don't want to live in the sea because I don't want to encounter sharks. Obviously, you know, it's not all that simple because dinosaurs did inhabit the same ecozones we do, but I believe that they are part of the original creation. Yeah, that part of that which we read. Animals include dinosaurs. Dinosaurs were animals. So that would be my understanding of the subject. I appreciate your call. I need to take a break at this point. We have another half hour coming up, and you can call in during that half hour if you want to. At this point, I just need to let you know that the narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. And if you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. You can donate there if you want, though the things there are free at thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds, so don't go away.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When the radio show is over, go to thenarrowpath.com where you can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. See you at thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, or you disagree with the host, want to say so, and why, well, you can call us here. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Now, I want to make this announcement. I don't think I've ever mentioned this, but I think it's necessary because from time to time, my call screener has told me that people call in and complain about something I do or say on the air to the call screener. Now, I just want you to know the call screener has nothing to do with what I say or do. If you want to ventilate your complaints to the call screener, it'll do no good because he doesn't go on the air. I do. If you have a complaint, go ahead and call me. I'll be glad to talk to you about it. My call screener is just there to screen calls and put them on so I can go on there. So anyone who calls the call screener to complain is, I don't know, maybe you're just getting it off your chest, but you're getting nowhere. Because the call screener says someone called and complained about this. I think, well, they should have called me. And one person called a moment ago complaining because I hung up before their call was over. Well, that is before their call was over, in their opinion. I've got a lot of people waiting. My lines are full most of the show. I can't go on and on and on with a caller, and I do give every caller a fair chance to state what they want to state, and this caller had done so. In fact, we had talked for a few minutes, and sounded like we'd covered his material. He might have wanted to go on and bring three or four more things up, but we have a lot of people waiting. So, sometimes I will hang up if it seems like the person doesn't realize their call is over. I don't generally hang up because I can't stand to talk to them or because, you know, because I can't talk to people I disagree with or things like that. It's just that we have to manage the time so we can get in as many calls as possible. And if you want to go on and on and on, it's going to be my decision whether you do so. So just so you know, don't complain to my call screener if you feel like you should have had more time on the air. He didn't make that decision. I did. Michael from Vacaville, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Hello.
Hey, Steve, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, yeah, I have two quick questions. They both kind of coincide with each other. So I've basically been in the Lord for about going on 5 years now, 4 to 5 years. And I was wondering if you kind of had an idea on what the Bible talks about, us seeking out spiritual parents, like a spiritual mother or father. And, if so, if the answer is yes, then should I be seeking them out, or should I just let God, like, lead me that way, or lead them to me, or what do you think?
Well, the Bible never talks about people seeking out someone like that, though there were people like Paul and Timothy, whom, you know, Paul referred to Timothy as his son in the faith, and Paul was no doubt like a father and a mentor to Timothy. Likewise, Peter referred to Mark as his son in the faith in 1 Peter chapter 5. So the truth is that sometimes an older Christian, in this case apostles, would take on a young protege and keep him under his wing and train him and, you know, provide, no doubt, nurture and work for him in the kingdom. It's very advantageous, I'm sure, for a young Christian to have an older mentor in the faith, like a father in the faith, so to speak. But it's not always the case that they are available. And the Bible never talks about go looking for one or find one. But you certainly might pray for one. You might pray that God would give you somebody in your life, in your circle, in your church or whatever, who's a mature Christian who would be willing to kind of, you know, take you under their wing and help bring you up in the faith, disciple you somewhat. If not, then you'll just have to make the best of following role models, you know, maybe from a distance. For example, probably my first role model besides my own father in Christianity was Chuck Smith. Now, I knew Chuck Smith, but I didn't spend time with him. He's a busy man. And yet his life served as a mentorship, in a sense. I learned a lot of things about being a Christian from what he said and from how he lived. Later on, I actually had mentors who are no longer living. George Mueller and Hudson Taylor and you know, famous Christians with A.W. Tozer, people who were dead at the time, had already died, but I still read their biographies, I still read what they wrote and things like that, and they were like an older Christian mentoring me. Sometimes you can't find somebody, I mean, there are people, but you can't always easily find them, who have the desire to take on a disciple or a protege to train up. But if you find one, more power to you. It's a good thing. But as far as the Bible saying something about going out looking for one, it doesn't say you should search for one. But you might keep your eyes open and say, oh, there's a Christian over there that I really admire. I think that person really knows the Lord. That person seems mature. Maybe I can ask if I can hang out with them sometimes, you know, and maybe God will develop a relationship there. So there's nothing wrong with initiating that on your own, but you're not necessarily commanded to do so, and there's no guarantee that every Christian will be fortunate enough to have someone like that in their life.
Gotcha. All right, so basically what you're saying is if I pray about it and I feel like I am, I found one and I have a conversation with them where I don't really have the opportunity or the time to carve out to kind of put me under their wing, then I'm pretty much okay, and I can just continue following the Lord through His Spirit pretty much. And
right,
there's
no obligation for you to have a mentor or somebody, you know, who's training you or anything like that. It's an advantage, but again, not everyone has one. We're not guaranteed to have them. And really, if you don't have that advantage, you still have God and you still have the Bible, and you still, right. You can look at older Christians that maybe aren't in your immediate circle. Like I said, some of the people that I feel mentored me were dead before I was alive, but their books, their biographies, you know, I feel like I know them. I've read four or five biographies, for example, of George Mueller, and I've read what he wrote. So, I mean, he's kind of a mentor, but you know, he died long before I was born. So, you know, you can find examples to follow. You know, it says in James chapter 5, take my brethren, the prophets, who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering, affliction, and of patience and perseverance. And then it mentions Job as a great role model. Here, the prophets that James mentions lived hundreds of years earlier than his readers. He's talking about Old Testament prophets, and he's writing hundreds of years after the prophets were dead, but he says, take them as examples, you know. So I guess a role model doesn't have to be a living person who's in your life. It can be anyone that's admirable, whose life you can reflect on and learn about and say, yeah, that's the way I think I should be. So that's what I'd recommend.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Awesome. I think that answers a lot. Thank you so much.
Okay, Michael. God bless you. Thank you for your call. Okay, our next caller is Max from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Max.
Hi, Steve. Good to talk to you. And I just want to say kudos to you and your call screener. I think you guys both run a pretty fair program, and you, I certainly appreciate it as an atheist, you giving a voice to an atheist on your airtime. So I really appreciate uh-huh. that. Sure. I just wanted to call back. Sounded like maybe Don or Ron in Vancouver across the river from me here in Portland had a book they wanted me to read, and I would absolutely love to find that book and read that book. I also wanted to suggest a book both to them and to your audience, Steve. You've probably heard of it, and I imagine many of your audience have as well. It's Why I Am Not a Christian.
I've read it many times. I've read it many times, yeah.
Excellent. Maybe you should do address the points made in it sometime. You do in your own way.
Yeah, there's a lecture. Yeah. There's a lecture at my website called Why I Am Still a Christian, and I begin by referencing Russell's book and some of the things he said. I go beyond what he said, but it begins by interacting with him. Actually, what he wrote was an essay by that name. There's a book called Why I'm Not a Christian by Bertrand Russell, but that's just the name of the first essay in the book. The other essays are on other things. But, I've read it many times. I've responded to it on several occasions.
I will absolutely have to look up that lecture and take a look. But, yeah, I actually have my copy here in front of me. And you are right. Why I'm Not a Christian is merely the first essay inside the book, which is a collection of essays. But
right.
then the second essay actually addresses Ron's question more specifically, which is, it's titled, Has Religion Made Useful Contributions to Civilization? And I wanted to say, I think the caller may have mischaracterized my argument. I'm not saying that Christianity hasn't made any positive contributions to the world. I'm saying that religion has not made any positive contributions to the world.
Right.
However, many Christians have, just the same way that many Muslims and Buddhists and atheists have. We all are complex, you know, we're multifaceted. We can create and destroy and benefit and contribute and you know, destroy.
I agree with part of that. And I agree that religion is not to be credited with as much as maybe some people credit it for, because religion has done a lot of damage too. And Christianity is not religion. Christianity is comprised of people who are followers of Christ and not simply people who go to a church that's called a Christian religious institution. And but you see, more to put a finer point on it, Christians are people who believe and follow what Jesus said in the Bible. And the Bible has made tremendous contributions to the betterment of society, certainly far more than the Quran has. I mean, the Quran doesn't even... If Western civilization had been influenced by the Quran instead of the Bible, we would have no equal rights for women. You know, we wouldn't have freedom of religion, because Christianity believes in freedom of religion, but Islam doesn't. We'd have, you know, people.
Can I share with you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. May I share with you my favorite Bible verse? And I know, coming from an atheist, that might sound strange. It's James 1:27, and the KJV reads it as this. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained from the world. So to me, it seems that the biblically advocated position on religion is, in fact, works-based. I just want to throw that out there and gather your thoughts on it.
Yeah, well, works-based, yeah. Christianity is a life of good works. That's absolutely true. Anyone who thinks that it's not is only paying attention to, maybe every alternate verse and ignored the other half. The Bible does say we're saved by grace. We're not saved by works, but we are saved for good works. That is, God saves us so that we will do good works. And James is very correct. It's, you know, the pure religion, as opposed to institutional religion, is spiritual, and it leads to a change of heart where somebody wants to serve the needy, and they want to avoid being stained by the world too. I mean, there's a change of heart that takes place when a person is a true Christian, and they have love. Jesus said, this is how people will know that that you're my disciples, if you have love one for another. So widows and orphans have always been a particular focus of benevolence for Christians. I mean, real people who follow Christ, I mean. Of course, there's a problem, of course, because not everyone who calls themselves a Christian has any, even the slightest interest in following Christ. There's people who call themselves Christians because they were born and raised in a church, but they've never met Christ or surrendered to him or made any decision to follow him. But they call themselves Christians, and that's where things do get confusing, and Christians sometimes get a bad name.
Would that surprise you that the notion of watching after those who need it and keep oneself, you know, undefiled from the gunk, from the junk of the world has to offer you, would it surprise you that that notion is actually advocated for in the texts of every major world religion? In other words, it's not specific or indigenous to Christianity alone. It's not unique to that. It seems to be more human than it is Christian.
Well, yeah, you know, every major religion has something in their literature that is essentially like the golden rule. I mean, I've seen a book that has a list of, you know, like from like 12 different major religions of the world, where the leader would say something equivalent to, you know, do to others what you want done to you. And that's essentially what the rule is for Christianity too. The difference is that Christianity requires that we do this as a result of being submitted to God and as agents of God and out of love for God. You see, Jesus said there's two commandments. One is definitely love your neighbor as you love yourself, which is do to others as you want done to you. But the first one is love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. So loving God and loving your neighbor are the two things that are necessary. Now, in order to love God, you have to know God. And God has been made known to us through Christ. And Christ came to reveal the Father to us, as the Bible says. So Christianity certainly has an ethic that's very similar in many respects to other religions, although every other religion has some things that aren't very consistent with loving. But the thing that's distinctive of Christianity is not that it's like the only religion that commands people to do good things. All religions command people to do good things. But Christianity calls upon us to do them for the glory of God, because we love God and because we are loyal to Christ. Loyalty to Christ will result in good works, but loyalty to Christ is the fundamental defining aspect of being a disciple or a Christian. So that's the difference. You'll find that, you know, I've got a Buddhist friend, Michael, from Santa Cruz area, who's been calling me for years here, and you probably have heard him because he calls so frequently, but he always wants to talk about how Christianity and Buddhism are kind of the same thing, you know, because they, you know, there's very similar ethics and so forth in them. And my point is always that, well, yeah, there's a similar ethic. I think all people who are sensitive people have similar ethics, whether even atheists. Lots of atheists believe in doing good. And I'm not saying atheists, therefore, you know, are bad people, but they do want to do good, too. So do Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus and other religious people, Zoroastrians and so forth. But the thing is that only if you're doing it for the sake of Christ's kingdom is it really Christian behavior. I'm not saying that it's bad behavior if you're not doing it for Christ. I'm just saying it isn't what Christianity is. Christianity is distinctly the promotion of the kingdom of Jesus Christ and his rule. And those who do so, they do receive something other religions don't offer. And that is, they receive the Holy Spirit dwelling in them. Jesus gives his spirit to his believers, who enables them to obey him. And so there's, you know, lots of religions tell people to do the right thing, But those religions don't necessarily give them the power to do it. So Christianity is not just a bunch of rules. It's a life based on a different dynamic than is provided anywhere else. Hey, Max, I need to take another call. My lines are full, but it's good to hear from you. That book, you know, How Christianity Changed the World, is a great book to pick up. So let's talk next to Alexa from Sacramento, California. Alexa, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. So I have a question. I was actually going to school recently, and there was a lot of talk of astrology. And I'm a Christian, and I don't practice any of that stuff. And I noticed that there was talk of Christianity and astrology, and there are some books on it. And so I know that in Luke 21:25, they do mention that there will be strange signs in the sun, moon, and stars. But is there, because I know practicing astrology is witchcraft, so how can those two even mix?
Yeah, well, so you've seen some books that are written by Christians or astrology from a Christian point of view, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it depends on what is called astrology. If people are using astrology as a means of divination, sort of like fortune telling and that kind of thing, that is divination. Mm-hmm. That is like witchcraft. That's forbidden. But if astrology simply means assigning meaning or getting information from the stars, the Bible does say in Genesis chapter 1 that when God made the stars, he made them for signs and for seasons and days and years. So signs carry information. It says about the stars in Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows forth his handiwork. Day unto day they utter speech, and night unto night they show forth knowledge. So there is something that is being communicated that God intended to be communicated, but it's not about my future. It's not about my personality. Astrology, in its popular pagan form, it suggests that the stars and the houses of the zodiac have power to influence your personality. If you happen to be born under a certain star sign, then you're going to have your personality, you know, affected by that. And, you know, that the alignment of stars on any given day would give you some kind of guidance about how your day is going to go. That's treating the stars as if they are deities. And the pagans did.
Right.
The pagans even named the planets and the stars after some of their pagan gods and so forth. So that's bad. It's not good to treat the stars as if they have power, as if they are deities. But to see them as communicating information is biblical. But it's one thing to say they communicate information, you know, but they're not conscious beings. They're not consciously doing that, and they don't have any power over us.
So that's just like, so for seasons, as far as like telling the weather and farming and all that stuff, then we can go by as far as astronomy goes or astrology.
Well, yeah, there are some Christian books about astronomy, so to speak, that teach that if you understand the constellations as they are intended to be understood, they actually are telling the story of Jesus. And you know, it's very detailed how, you know, the names of the stars and the names of the constellations, how they seem to tell the story of Christ. Not everyone would see it that way, but there are Christian books that do that. One of them is called The Gospel in the Stars. Another is called, I think it's called the Message of the Maseroth. Maseroth is the Hebrew word for the zodiac. I think there's one called The Message of the Maseroth. They're from The Gospel in the Stars. And so forth. These are Christian books written by ministers. I mean, one was written by a couple of them written by Presbyterian ministers. One of them was written by Henry Morris. He didn't write the book, but he had a chapter on it with the same kind of information in his book, Many Infallible Proofs. A Christian apologist has it. So these are mainstream Christian people who are presenting the thesis that the constellations and so forth that God put there are intended to tell a story, just like a big sign written in the sky, and that story is about Christ. But none of these people would say that whatever sign you were born under is going to have some determinative effect on who you are or what you're like, or that or that you should consult these signs to see what you should do today or not do today. That's an entirely different kind of astrology. So the kind of astrology that is a kind of divination is what's forbidden.
I see, because there's so many people who are, I guess, because astrology is just huge right now with the energies and the crystals, and I see it with so many teenagers,
right.
And I know that some people are really trying to twist scripture and then add this divination in it.
Yeah, don't go there. That's not the right way to understand it. Okay, let's talk to Joe from Indianapolis before we run out of time. Joe, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. I listen to you all the time. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Okay, I want to reiterate on this guy that was talking to you about a half an hour ago about murder. And then another guy about committing suicide. Now, you know, I've been a Christian for, I'm 57 years old. I've been a Christian for a long time. I went to church with my mom when I was little and got into the Word. Not saying that I was really deeply into it, but I know what I read in the Bible. And to my understanding is, when God said, "Thou shalt not kill," he meant it, that thou shalt not kill, like he was telling the guy. But he was saying something like, well, I don't believe that when, and I've been in the military too, that when... when we have to go off a war and we end up taking lives, that's not murder. And well, I disagree with that because it is. You know, if God gives us and even back in the Old Testament when he gave Moses the okay, Joshua the okay, and others the okay to go to battle, then because he knows the outcome of everything, you know. So, and my understanding is that when God gives you the okay to do things like that, then you'll be fine. But when man gives you the okay to do stuff like that, go to battle and go to war, man does not get the okay from the Lord, you know? And
I hear you. And let me just say this, because we're going to run out of time if I don't jump in. But I agree with you that killing in war can be murder. For example, if you kill civilians and so forth. Now, in the Bible, not all killing is called murder. For example, capital punishment is not. God commands that murderers be put to death. Now, putting a murder to death, the Bible says the land cannot be cleansed of the guilt of innocent blood except by the blood of the murderer. So, you know, to kill a murderer is just as much commanded as it is commanded that no one commit murder. But you see, killing a murderer is different than murder. Murder is killing an innocent party who doesn't deserve to die. Capital punishment is killing a person who has done something worthy of death, and it's the government basically giving them their right due. So there are times when people have done things worthy of death. Now, if somebody breaks into your house and is going to kill your wife, the Bible actually indicates this is in the Old Testament. Some might say it's not so in the New Testament, but in the Old Testament, it was not murder if you killed a man who broke into your house in the night to do harm to your family. That was not considered murder if you killed him. And in wartime, it was not considered murder. But it is possible at wartime to go beyond the killing of people who are trying to kill you and to go on and kill civilians, and that, I believe, would be getting into the realm of murder. So even in war, we can't just kill everybody, but I do think defending yourself or your family is in the Bible treated as not murder, even if you end up killing somebody in that defensive behavior. We're out of time, I'm sorry to say. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. We got tons of resources. They're all free. You can donate there if you wish, or you can just take the resources and use them. That's thenarrowpath.com. Hope you'll tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion. God bless you.